nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So today's lecture, there really isn't any new material. It's just to get a little more comfortable with all of this. So we're going to talk these equations that we've developed for electric current and heat current, they're coupled together. So I call these coupled current equations. And we just want to say a few words about them. So here's our familiar equations in the form that we derive them in most naturally. If you look at these equations, it looks like there are two forces that drive current flow. There's a force due to a temperature, or due to a voltage difference, which is really a difference in Fermi levels or electrochemical potentials. So differences in Fermi levels drive current. There's also a contribution due to a difference in temperature. Differences in temperature are a driving force for currents. But force is in quotations. You know, why is force in quotation marks? You know, you could think about the temperature difference giving an electric field in the device and putting a force minus Q times the electric field on the electrons. That is a real physical force pushing the electrons. If you look at the temperature gradient, temperature isn't exerting any physical force. Carriers are just diffusing down a temperature gradient due to their random thermal motion. It's just a statistical thing, or people call it a statistical force or an entropic force. But it sort of looks like a force. A change in something drives current. Now, let's look at these signs, because you always have to be able to figure out physically what should the sign be so you know if you've done the algebra right. This is what I should have been more careful on in the last lecture. So writing the equations the way we have them here in the blue box. Okay. Now, the conductance is going to be greater than zero, right? I always want the conductance or resistance to be a positive number, right? That's nice. So you can see if I apply a positive voltage to the right, I'll attract electrons. They will flow to the right. The current flows in the opposite direction. That means that it flows in that contact. We're calling that a positive current. So everything's happy. Positive voltage gives me a positive current. Okay, how about a temperature? Figure out what the sign should be. What is the sign of SG now? Is it negative or positive? Well, I have to figure out what would happen. If I were to apply a positive temperature difference, so the right contact is hotter, physically I expect electrons to diffuse away from the hot contact. So the electrons are going to move in the opposite direction here, the opposite direction that this little arrow here is showing me now. That means that the current will flow out the contact instead of in. Right? So if SG is a positive number, I'll get a negative current, which physically is what I should get. So SG must be a positive quantity. If you look at those integral expressions and we work out the integrals, that's what we should get. If I look down here at the heat current, I could go through and I could check everything. If I apply a positive voltage on the right contact, I'll attract electrons. They'll move in the direction that this little electron is moving with its arrow. They'll carry heat in the same direction. We've defined heat flow to be positive when it flows in the positive x direction. So temperature is positive, SG is positive, voltage is positive, sign's okay. What if there's just a temperature difference here, though? The electrons will flow in the opposite direction. They'll carry heat in the opposite direction. So I should get a negative heat flux. That means the electronic heat conduction has to be zero. So remember, this is not the whole thermal conductance. It's the thermal conductance due to the electrons. And it's the zero here means it's the thermal conductance when the voltage is equal to zero. It's the ratio of the heat current to the temperature difference when the voltage is zero. Yes?
Here, I think also it's important to define the difference in temperature. For example, the difference in voltage is already defined by this source, voltage source, delta V. But you have at the same time defined delta T. Where is the positive and what is the negative? Or where is the cold and where is the...
Yeah. So it's easy to see here. I'm applying a voltage source, so I know what delta V is. There has to be some kind of heater or some kind of heat bath to maintain the temperatures constant, right? That's in there somewhere too. So the experimental conditions might be such that I put this on a big heat bath and maintain it at ambient, so that's T equals 300. I have some type of heater here and some kind of feedback circuit that maintains the temperature at some hotter temperature or some... So experimentally, I have to do that. That's a little harder to show than the voltage source, but...
What I'm saying is, you have to say where is the T, what is the positive, the hot, the cold, what is the delta T, maybe it's negative.
Sure, and delta V may be negative. So the way I've applied, the way I've defined delta V is it's the voltage at contact 2 minus the voltage at contact 1. The way I define delta T is that the temperature of contact 2 minus the temperature of contact 1. Either one may be positive or negative. Just depends on which one's hotter or which one's colder, which voltage is higher, which one is lower. Okay, yeah.
So the heat current and the electronic current, they should be in the opposite direction.
So, you know, this is what... You know, what I'm doing it, what I, the way I'm doing the signs now seem to be the way that it's most natural to do it in this Landauer formalism. Okay, because you like to write positive currents when you apply positive voltages. Turns out that this positive current is flowing in the minus x direction. Later on, when we solve the Boltzmann equation, it'll be more natural to define positive currents as flowing in the plus x direction. So that's part of the issue that we're having here is we're, you know, for the heat current, it always just seems to make sense to have it positive in the positive x direction. But for the electric current, it seems most natural here to find a positive flowing into the contact. You get positive currents when you apply positive voltages.
So the way we have defined here, like IQ is negative of I, like in sine.
Well, IQ is positive when it flows in the plus X direction. When electrons flow in the plus X direction.
So the current is in the negative X direction.
But the way, I haven't, but I've defined my current to be positive when it flows into the contact. So a current flowing in the negative X direction is a positive current, right? Right? This is the way circuits people typically do it, right?
No, I'm saying that from those equations, it seems like if delta V is positive, and I and IQ will have the same sign.
Yes, they will. They'll both be positive.
Okay.
So yeah. Yeah. A positive voltage will give a positive current flowing in. A positive voltage will give also give a positive heat flux. All right. So we have to be we have to be consistent, and that's.
If it's a p-type semiconductor, we should suppose SG to be negative, or the expression should be changed to plus. The first one.
I'm not going to attempt that here because I might probably get the sign wrong. Maybe we'll do that on Friday. But that's what you should do. You could write down these equations for a p-type semiconductor, and you could say, you know, what sign should they be? And the way I would do is exactly the same arguments that I'm using here. The holes will flow away. They'll carry the current in the same direction that they flow, and we can figure it all out.
When you apply a positive bias, so. Even though there is a temperature difference, how would the, like, you know, the electrons come on the barrier to go to the other side? Like, you know, because you're applying the by, you know, voltage difference, it's gonna, you know, just gonna be level.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna be level, like barrier. So that even though there's a temperature difference, like, you know, electron on the left hand side, how would it come on the barrier just go to create like IQ current there?
So remember when we talked about, I don't have this picture of my single level model. The electrons had to absorb thermal energy to get over that barrier. That's why we had cooling at one side. When the electrons came out the other side, they dropped down the barrier into the contact. That's why the other side heated. So that's precisely where the absorption of heat is coming from, so that the electrons can get over that barrier. Yeah. Okay. All right, so I guess this is the answer to your question. Positive voltage gets positive electric current, gets positive heat current. Everything like that. Now, we'll say a little bit about this later on too, just to make sure we get everything straight. I've written everything in terms of conductance. Right? 1/ohms, or thermal conductance, whatever units it are. More naturally, you'll see these equations written in terms of conductivity. And then the units are different depending on whether you're in 1D, 2D, or 3D. Right? If you're in 3D, the conductance is conductivity times A divided by L. And the thermal conductance is the thermal conductivity times A divided by L. Right? Now, we're writing in these forms because it applies to any dimension. Right? In 2D, in 3D, the number of modes goes proportional to A. In 2D, it goes proportional to W. Transmission goes proportional to 1/L. Okay, so we can work things out in any dimension using these general expressions. When you get all done, people might want to know, what is the conductivity? Well, it'll be proportional. You just divide by A over L. Okay, so we'll have to keep that in mind. And now one other minor point here. Remember when we were, current is driven by F1 minus F2. And what we did is a Taylor series expansion where we first held the temperature constant and did a Taylor series expansion in Fermi level. Then we held the Fermi levels constant and did a Taylor series expansion in temperature. Okay, so we just did a Taylor series expansion and differentiated this F0. Now, if I'm doing the second one for temperature, a convenient way to do that would be to write the argument of the Fermi function as capital theta, E minus EF over KT. And then I could use the chain rule. I could have a df d theta, and this is the change in theta across the two contacts. So a df d theta is just like a df dE, except there's a KT in there. And now the change in theta, then, is the change in 1/temperature. Right. So this may look like a natural point, but the proper thermodynamic driving force is really not gradients in temperature, it's gradients in 1/temperature. It just comes naturally out of this, right? Because we're differentiating a 1/T. So that actually turns out to be important. There's this whole field of non-equilibrium statistical thermodynamics where you talk about these kinds of coupled flows, not just for electrons and heat, but for other particles too. And people show that you could just write, you know, very generally, you would expect the current to be proportional to the change in Fermi level. It's properly related to the change in inverse temperature. And to the heat current is related proportional to the change in Fermi level and to the change in inverse temperature. When you write the equations in this form, then there are some really powerful symmetry relations that you can use. And it becomes, you know, really important when you apply magnetic fields and things. And you start having coupled flows and you want to know which ones are equal to other ones. Then you have to properly define the thermodynamic forces and the thermodynamic currents. And when you do that, the currents are called generalized fluxes of quantities. F1 and F2 are called generalized forces. They might not be physical forces, they might be statistical forces, but you have to properly define them thermodynamically. And when you do, you find that L12 is equal to L21. We don't have to have this T times S in the relation that we had. And when you put magnetic fields in, then I think it's L12 of plus B is equal to L21 of minus B. There are things like that that you can work out that become very useful. So, for example, we have another problem. You know, a difference in temperature is always going to produce a flow of heat or a heat current. But if I've got, say, gas particles, a difference in pressure will produce a flow of mass or particles. The two are going to be coupled because the gas particles have thermal energy. And it's going to turn out that those two are coupled and that the flow of heat per unit pressure difference is going to be equal to the flow of matter per temperature difference. Because they're coupled flows and they're going to have these cross terms and that's going to work also. So there's a nice, you know, deep theory about all of this. It was a subject of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1968. I think this fellow did the work long before that. It took a long time for him to get the Nobel Prize. But there's this whole theory of coupled flows that we're just applying in a specific example to electrons, but it applies much more generally. So if you want to see how this works out in much more detail, look at this book by Smith, Janik, and Adler. There are two chapters that are just devoted to this whole idea of coupled flows and thermodynamics. And I say a little bit about it in my book, but we really aren't going to say any more about it. I just want to point out that this Kelvin relation, the Peltier coefficient is temperature times Seebeck coefficient, is just one specific example of something that's much more general. All right. Okay, so let me just say a few words then about measurement considerations. And here, you know, it's just going to be descriptive. You go in the lab, you have to do some measurements. The form of the equations that we like to use are the bottom form, right? So let's see if we can figure out in working with that. The way we get the bottom form is we just rearrange the top form. So if I solve the first equation for delta V, I get delta V is current divided by conductance over SG divided by G times delta T. Resistance is 1 over conductance. Seebeck coefficient, I'm going to put the minus sign in there, right? Because we like to define the Seebeck coefficient to be negative for electrons, positive for holes. So if I do that, I get this expression delta V is equal to R minus S delta T. You can check the signs, right? If I put a positive temperature on the right contact, a positive temperature difference, if T2 is greater than T1, electrons will diffuse away, but the Seebeck coefficient is defined under open circuit conditions, so I have to develop some potential to pull them back. There's going to be a positive voltage that's going to develop there. And if I write the equations this way, to get a positive voltage, S has to be negative. Right? And I can do the same thing. I can now take the second equation, and where I had a delta V, I can insert this expression for delta V. Now I've got a term proportional to current, which is what I want, and I have two terms proportional to the temperature difference. That's by the way I've done this. So if I collect up terms, SG divided by G in the first term here is minus the Seebeck coefficient. T times the Seebeck coefficient by the Kelvin relation is the Peltier coefficient pi. And this was minus the Seebeck coefficient, so I have a minus sign there. So let's see if that works. If I have a positive electric current, it means the current is flowing in. It means electrons must be flowing out. If electrons flow out, it means that the heat current must be carried in the plus x direction and be positive. So the positive electric current minus times a negative Peltier coefficient gives me a positive heat current. Things work. And then I have heat flowing down a temperature gradient. But notice, and you have to be careful about this, when most people talk about the electronic heat conduction, they're talking about this electronic heat conduction, not the one we derived in the first form. And this is the heat that flows per unit temperature difference when the device is open circuited. The first one was the heat that flows, the heat current that flows per delta T when the voltage is zero. Right? Two different experimental conditions. And the electronic heat conductivity is related, the two are related by kappa naught, the one in the first expressions, minus T times SG squared over G. Right? So most of the time when people are talking about electronic heat conduction, this is the one. You have to be careful that you know which one they're talking about. Okay. Peltier coefficient is less than zero. Electronic heat conduction is greater than zero. All right. Okay, so we understand these two forms of the equations, one that we derive everything in, one that we do the experiments in. And as I mentioned earlier, people usually like to think about it in terms of resistivity or conductivity rather than conductance. So let's just back up and do some really quick, simple things here. You remember about resistivity. We know how to calculate the resistance of this chunk of semiconductor from the Landauer formula. We also know that the resistance is proportional to L over A, because the conductance is proportional to A over L. A, because the number of channels is proportional to the cross-sectional area. L, because the transmission is inversely proportional to the length. So we can write the resistance as resistivity times L over A. And then people like to divide out the L over A so that you just have a material parameter. It has units ohm centimeters in 3D. If we had a 2D resistor, the resistance, the conductance would be proportional to W over L, not A over L. And when I worked it out, I would get a resistivity in sheet resistance in 2D that would have different units. Right? Okay. What point was I making here? I'm not sure. All right, and let's remember how you do this in a very simple way. Current is charge divided by time. So it's a total amount of charge that flows per unit time. If I look in a semiconductor and find the total amount of charge in that, it's Q times the electron density per unit volume times the volume of the resistor, cross-sectional area times length. That's the amount of charge. It flows out in a time tau. What's the time? Well, velocity is mu times electric field. Electric field is velocity divided by length. Voltage divided by length. Tau is length divided by average velocity. So it's length divided by mu, v divided by L. So there's L squared over mu times v. If I take that transit time and divide it into the charge Q, we simply get our conventional expression NQ mu A over L. All right, that's the 606 way of looking at it. You know, what's the 656 way of looking at it? We start with the idea that we know how to compute the conductance. That we can always do. We have this general formula. By definition, the conductivity is the conductance divided by A over L. So we take this expression. We know that T is lambda divided by L, and number of modes is proportional to cross-sectional area. So when I divide through by A over L, the L disappears in the T expression, and we get a number of conducting channels per unit area. So if we don't want to use NQ mu, if we're working with some new problem, we're working with graphene or some new material, we're not quite sure how to apply NQ mu, that 606 expression. Having taken this course, we would start with the general expression for conductance in any conductor, and we would just divide by A over L. That's the definition of conductivity. And under certain conditions, we would get NQ mu. All right. All right, we could do the same thing with sheet conductance, but I seem to be belaboring the point now. In 2D, you know, conductance is, how would we do this in 2D? Yeah, we think of our 3D conductor as being very thin in one direction, so its conductance is still A divided by L. The cross-sectional area is the width times the thickness, that little t. If I move the thickness out front, then I can lump everything out front into the sheet conductance. And the sheet conductance is the sheet carrier density, which is the density per unit volume times the thickness T in the confined direction times Q mu. That's the sheet conductance. All right. So that's how we relate these Landauer conductances to sheet conductivities. And you can do it in 1, 2, or 3D. And people, when you read papers, this is what people frequently report. not the conductances, but the sheet conductances in various dimensions. Okay, so how would you do these measurements? It's very easy. We would go into the lab, we have some resistor, we presumably know its length, we have two metal contacts. We can measure the resistance just by shooting a current through contacts one and two and measuring the voltage that develops. All right. So I simply take the measured voltage, divide it by the current, and I would hope that I've measured the resistance of the material, and I can relate that to mean free paths and band structure and various material parameters. Unfortunately, these two contacts probably have some resistance. Right? And if I make the resistor very, very long, I might be able to ignore that. Or if I plot the resistance versus length, I may be able to take the slope and subtract out the contact resistance. But what if I only have one device? Right, then my measurement is contaminated by these contact resistances. So people will frequently use what's called a four-point probe. So now you have to make your resistor with lithography, and it's just a little more involved to make it, but you would etch out a pattern like this. The resistor will have some width. The length L is between these sets of four contacts I'm having here. I'll force a current through contacts 5 and 0. And if I force a current through contact 5 and 0, I can measure the voltage between contacts 1 and 2. If I use a high impedance voltmeter, I won't draw any current through contacts 1 and 2. So that if there's any resistance between contact, the metal contact 2 and the semiconductor, or the metal contact 1 and the semiconductor, there won't be any current flowing through that resistor. So I won't measure any volt drop there. So I will just measure the volt drop from between contacts 2 and 1. If I know the dimensions, L and W, then I've measured the sheet resistance. So that's what is known as a four-probe measurement. People do it to eliminate contact resistance. The particular geometry I've shown here is usually referred to as a Hall bar geometry, because it's the same geometry that people use for making Hall effect measurements. And it's a little more work. Now, because it's a little more work to actually produce that structure, sometimes people do this technique in a different way. They do these four probe measurements in a different way, on a different geometry that's easier to produce. Or maybe even you can take a wafer and cleave it into little pieces. And you have a piece that maybe not exactly square. It might have some shape that's something like this. And it has four contacts that you place around the perimeter somewhere. Now, the assumption is that these four contacts are small. There's also an assumption that there aren't any holes inside this. If you have a hole inside this, it doesn't work. And that the contacts are on the perimeter. But the shape can be any arbitrary 2D shape. Now you can do a four-probe measurement this way. You can force a current through two of those contacts, and you can measure a voltage across the other two. All right. Now, it's not immediately obvious what it is you're measuring here. It's some kind of four-probe measurement. You're forcing a current through two contacts, you're measuring a voltage through two other contacts. It hasn't got that nice, simple, clear geometry the other one did where we knew what we were measuring. But you could do that, and I could define the ratio of the voltage I measure between contacts 2 and 3 to the current that I insert through contacts 1 and 4 as some kind of resistance. I'll call it R sub 1, 4, current in contact 1, out contact 4, slash 2, 3, voltage measured positive at contact 2 with respect to contact 3. All right. So I could do all kinds of things. I could go around and I could say that, well, let me move it and let me shoot the let me move this current source over, just rotate it over here to the top and insert the current in contact 2 and take it out contact 1. So in contact 2, out contact 1. And let me measure the voltage between the other two contacts. positive at contact 3 and negative with respect to contact 4. All right? If I did that, I would get something with the units of ohms. I'll call that R21/34. Now, it can be shown by this very clever fellow in the 1950s that if you do this measurement on a two-dimensional sample, then e to the minus pi over sheet resistance of that first resistance plus e to the minus pi over sheet resistance times that second resistance is equal to 1. Right? Is that obvious to anyone? All right. There's a little derivation in the book where I do it on a simpler geometry. But now, that means we've measured these two resistances in the lab. We know them. The only thing you don't know in that expression is the sheet resistance. That's what we're trying to measure, the properties of the film, 1 over nq mu. You solve that little equation, and you have measured the sheet resistance. And as I said, it doesn't matter exactly what that shape is. You might have just cleaved it out and broken off a wafer, and it's just some kind of shape that's sort of like this, but not exactly. So you get the sheet resistance. And that's a very powerful technique. It's called the Van der Pauw method, and it's something you'll hear about frequently. Has anyone used it? Some of you are doing measurements. Anybody, you've used Van?
You're in 557.
You use a Van der Pauw method, or do you use a four-point probe with them all in line?
Well, like the space structure, similar to what you've shown.
So sometimes, you know, you'll take a wafer, and you want to measure its resistivity, and you'll put down four probes, you know, and you'll shoot a current through the outside too, and you'll measure a voltage across the inside too, and then there's some complicated, you know, 2D pattern of flow there that you can show is a simpler relation to this. You can actually mathematically solve it then. Is this the kind of thing you do in 557?
Well, in 557 we did it two ways, I believe. One way was almost identical to what you've shown here. The other way was like a transmission line where you kind of measure the over the different lengths, and then you can derive the
right two. So you'll hear this frequently. People will be either do Harbaugh geometry measurements or they'll do Van der Pauw measurements. They're trying to do four probe measurements in order to reduce the series resistance. Now, there's another thing that we have to worry about. Experimentally, we're not always sure what we're doing. All right. That is, we're not always sure whether everything is maintained at a constant temperature, or it may be easier experimentally to ensure adiabatic conditions, zero heat flow. You may be able to put thermal insulators around the sample such that no heat flows in or out. Then the temperature will be what it is. Or you may be able to put the sample on a very good thermal conductor and hold its temperature to be something constant. In general, you're somewhere in between, and it may not be clear which condition you're in. So let's see. If we were to measure, let's go back to the two probe measurement. Let's say the series resistance is small, so I'm not worrying about it. So I think no problem, we can measure the sheet resistance of this film. We'll just measure the resistance, and we'll use our little formula. It's R times I minus Seebeck coefficient times delta T. But what's delta T? It might not be obvious. Well, I've got this other expression here, heat current. And I could consider two different experimental conditions. The first is I've got a really nice heat sink. So this second term in V21 is zero, and I just directly measure the sheet resistance, no problem. The second condition is maybe the experimental conditions are closer to adiabatic. There's no heat flowing in or out, but I don't necessarily have a good thermal heat sink. Well, I could then set the heat current equal to zero, and I could solve the heat current equation for the temperature difference. I'll get a temperature difference that's minus pi divided by electronic heat conduction. I could insert that temperature difference in the voltage expression. And what you'll find then is that when you measure the voltage and divide it by the current, you're not just measuring the resistance of the device, you get something extra. All right. So these things affect the experimental accuracy. And people who are careful experimentalists worry a lot about things like this, either trying to maintain the conditions in one or the other, or trying to figure out, OK, I've got two limits here now. How big could the errors be? Yes?
Is there a
Is there a question? Okay. All right. So in this class, we can't say an awful lot about these, but this is, you know, very important if you go in the lab. We'll talk mostly about the theory about how you interpret the measurements, but it's just as important that you do the measurements properly. And I can point you to some papers where you can read. I do talk a little bit more about this in my book, but there's another book and this classic paper where you can hear more about it. Okay, and what I want to do now in the last few minutes is just go back to thermoelectrics and say some general things about thermoelectrics. So we talked Friday about how you could think about these thermoelectric coolers. You got an N-type semiconductor, a P-type semiconductor. We force a current through them in the bottom of the N-type, over the top, out the P-type, and then out the other contact. Electrons flow down, holes flow down. They carry their kinetic energy with them, so the top cools, the bottom heats, and we've created a cooler. Right. Now, there's this very good question about how do we think about the holes. We're going to talk about that on Friday, because that's... But physically, if I wanted to think about what's happening, it would be easiest for me to think about this in terms of holes here.
Could you make one possible application would be something like use heat to power?
Yeah, thank you for that question. All right, so there's a figure of merit that tells you how efficiently you can cool, cooling power divided by electrical power, and it's related to this figure of merit ZT, which you hear people talk about. All right, now your question. How could you turn this around? What if we heated the top side and kept the cool side maybe at ambient temperature or something? Okay, the heat would force the carriers away from it. It would force the electrons down. It would force the holes down. The electric current would flow up in the N-type, down in the P-type. So I could hook a light bulb to those two contacts and force the current out and generate power from waste heat. There's a lot of interest in that also. So this is thermoelectric power generation. If you go through the efficiency of this process, it turns out to depend on the same material parameters, ZT. So a lot of times if you work on thermoelectrics, the only thing you worry about is ZT. How do I find a material or a structure that can give me a better ZT? And there is a little industry that does this. You know, there are a lot of special purpose applications. So I understand that when NASA sends these deep space probes out, where it's going to go outside the solar system, it's going to need power for a long, long time. It has to be reliable because you don't want it to break. You have this radioisotope heat generator, and you have thermoelectric devices, so it generates heat, produces power. This way, there's no sun around to do any solar cells or anything. So it's a proven, highly reliable technology when cost isn't the primary consideration. There are a lot of applications in the Department of Defense for things like cooling lasers and sensors and things like that. There's also a commercial market, but it's pretty small these days. These are small numbers, 30 to 50 million. There's a market for thermoelectric power generation. So I understand that it's in places like northern Canada, where it would be, there isn't much sunlight. It's really hard to truck fuel up there. But you can, you've got to heat. You have to have heat anyway. You might as well use the waste heat and generate electrical power. So it can be cost competitive in some very special niche applications. And there's a small market for cooling. I think you may even be able now to get heat coolers in automobile heat seats, your seat that are thermoelectric. They're not particularly efficient, but they're right where you need it, so they make you feel cool. So this automobile market is actually one that people are thinking could be an important application for this technology. You could also take the waste heat from the engine and convert it back into electricity and reduce the size of the alternator you need to power it. So we could look at some things. I'll go through this quickly, and I'll ask you to go through it and check my algebra more carefully later on. But we could ask ourselves some questions, like if we have a heat engine, what's the maximum efficiency with which we could convert that heat to electrical power? And we know the answer, Right? The answer, the thermodynamics tells us that we have this Carnot's theorem. So we have a specific device. We know that the maximum that we can get out is given by 1 minus the ratio of the cold side to the hot side. Can we see where that would come from this thermodynamic device? Well, we have to have current flow. If we're going to produce electrical power out of the heat, we have to have current flow through this structure. Okay, so here's my current equation. Current flows when there's a difference between F1 and F2. All right. So what I'm going to do is to heat contact 1 and keep contact 2 cold and see if I can drive a current out the way we did and see what power I get. So F1 is the Fermi function of contact 1. F2 is a Fermi function of contact 2. I need to make F1 greater than F2 in order to get electrical power out. So I need the argument of the first one to be less than the argument of the second one. E minus EF1 is Q1, the heat absorbed in the first contact that we're trying to convert to useful work. Q2 is E minus EF2, it's the heat dissipated. So we conclude that in order to get any electrical current out and make F1 greater than F2, we have to have Q1 over T1 less than Q2 over T2. Otherwise, nothing will flow. All right, now how do we get the efficiency? Well, the thermal energy that we absorb at the side that we heated is E minus EF1. This is what gives us the energy for it to hop up and flow. The thermal energy that we dissipate in the other side is E minus EF2. The net thermal energy that we can convert into electrical power and produce something useful is the difference between what we absorb minus what we dissipate. The efficiency is just the ratio between the heat power we put in contact 1, which we heated up, divided by the net thermal energy that we can get out and produce useful work. So it's 1 minus the ratio Q2 over Q1. I can divide the top by T2, multiply by T2, divide the bottom by T1, multiply the bottom by T1. And I can remember that to get any heat to flow, I may have a typo. This was a less than sign, I think. Check me, you can get extra credit. Right. Even if you all send that to me, you'll all get extra credit. But remember, we had this relation. I think it was Q1 over T1 is less than Q2 over T2. The best that we can do is to make the two equal. This ratio would be 1. So the absolute maximum efficiency then would be 1 minus T2 over T1. Remember, T2 is the one I'm holding cold. T1 is the one I generated heat for. So it obeys thermodynamics. Right? We knew that in advance, but it's kind of reassuring to see we have a specific device. We knew nothing about thermodynamics. But in the end, when we compute the maximum efficiency, we don't violate thermodynamics. All right. I think I'm going to skip over this one because we're just about out of time. And maybe on Friday, this is a short one, but maybe on Friday we will do this one also. And actually, I'm going to skip over a few. So I'm going to use Friday as my catch-up time. But I'll leave you with this. Remember I said that basically what everybody worries about when they work on thermoelectric devices is the figure of merit ZT. People first realized, remember Seebeck coefficient, Peltier effect, they were discovered in the 1800s. This fellow Ioffe in Russia appreciated in the late 1940s that semiconductors could make very good thermoelectric materials. And they very rapidly began to develop the technology and identify materials that worked well, materials like bismuth, telluride, and other alloys. And after a lot of work, the figure of merit approached 1. And it's basically been 1 now for like 40 to 50 years. There's been lots of work, lots of searching for different materials. Now, the thing is, in order to compete with things like compressors for refrigerators or with other power generation technologies, you need a ZT that is significantly higher, 2 to 3. All right, if you could do that, the impact would be enormous. Okay, but people have worked for 40 to 50 years without success. Very recently, you started to read papers in the last 4, 5, 6 years where you started to see reports of figures of merit that are significantly above 1. And this is what's gotten everybody excited, you know, that maybe there is some hope to turning this into a really large-scale technology. So you can see various techniques, quantum dots, super lattices, nano dots, silicon nanowires, various types of powders and other materials. Now, this is still a very new field. You know, and whenever you do something new, you know, for a while, there's a lot of uncertainties. There's even some skepticism now about whether all of these measurements can be believed, whether they're even true. But that's the way it is in any brand new field. But there does seem to be something here. At least some of them seem to be solid. That there appear to be new ways. They all have to do with structuring matter on the nanoscale that you can achieve that. And that's what's got everybody exciting. Okay, so some of the loose ends here that I didn't have time for, we'll come back and revisit on Friday.